Okay, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We'll start this Production Division Council symposia. The Production Division Council last year proposed to change a little bit the format and do a symposia that would have an interest of a more wide audience. We actually requested that to be at 5 o'clock, to have not competing abstracts at the same time, but that was not possible because it's very difficult to planning. We thought that would be very interesting to have a talk on dairy products and human health. And there has been in the last 5-10 years a lot of small groups of people distributing on internet on other venues bad news about how bad milk is for our health. Actually, about 4 years ago, I had the opportunity to spend 7 months at the University of Reading, and I was shocked because I was completely unaware that anybody would ever think that milk would be bad for our health. And during this time, I learned a little bit through the projects I was involved with Professor Alan Gibbons on these issues and trying to get scientific evidence of what was the truth behind whether milk and dairy products are healthy or not. Well, you probably don't know I am. When I returned back to Barcelona 1 week after, I went through my yearly health check that the university provides me, and was the first time in my life that when I sat down with the doctor, he told me, you have your cholesterol high. And I said, so what? He said, well, you're going to have a risk of heart disease. So what do I have to do? And he pulled from the desk a photocopy where in the very first line said, reduce consumption of dairy products. And coming from where I was coming after 7 months at Reading, I said, what a bad word. I hope that by the end of the presentation of Professor Gibbons, you will understand my bad words and my reaction. I'm still drinking and eating dairy products. My doctor at university still have the same page. It's people tell me that still have the same page under the desk. So today we have Professor Ian Gibbons from the University of Reading. He's as you can see, involved in a project that is called Food Chain and Health Research. Was involved in a European project called Lead Gene related to human health, and also in a cost action within the European Union that basically tries to relate the relationship between feed, animals, and the animal food and its relationship to human health. I think that he will provide a good insight, objective scientific interpretation of current data relating milk and dairy product consumption and incidence on human health.
Thank you very much, Sergio, Mr. Chairman. You almost did my talk, actually, in about 5 minutes. We'll touch on cholesterol, I promise you. Can I just start by saying it's a great pleasure to be over here this afternoon and to be able to present some of our recent data to you. And I would just also like to acknowledge the initiative, really, of the chairman and his group for establishing this session this afternoon, and obviously also ADSA for partially sponsoring me to be here, but also to thank EAAP, who has also partially sponsored me to be here and have supported this session. And just while on the subject of EAAP, at the EAAP meeting in the end of August, which is held in Crete, the COST project, which Sergio mentioned at the beginning, has a whole day session there. So if anybody wants a bit of more warm weather in Crete, you'll hear more about this then. Okay, I just also want to acknowledge the contribution that my collaborators in this whole epidemiological exercise played, particularly Professor Peter Elwood. He's an epidemiologist of long standing. Some of you may have come across some of his papers some years ago. And he's still very active. He's semi-retired, but very, very active. And as a kind of inspiration, really, to try and get some of the facts out into the open. So, started badly. I thought we would just start by reminding ourselves of one or two issues that we face in the world in which we live today, because they're relevant to the considerations about diet as a whole. And we face two major trends. We face several trends, actually, but there are two major trends. At least we do in Europe, and I guess it's possibly the same here too. One is, we've heard quite a bit about this already at this meeting. I heard some discussion about it yesterday. Trends in obesity, and you can see the predictions. These are UK figures. Predicted trends suggested by 2050. Roughly 50% of the population will be obese. My own feeling is that those lines won't be as straight as that, actually. But nevertheless, it's still a big issue. And the other issue that we face is that we're all getting older. Well, we are. But the problem is that the age structure of the EU, is also getting older. And that brings with it a whole range of different issues, economic issues, socioeconomic issues. But it also means that the fact that the population is getting older means that the population is more susceptible to chronic disease. Age is a risk factor from all sorts of things, actually. And of course, if we think about these two trends almost coming together at some point in the future, unless something is done, it could be quite catastrophic for a whole range of reasons. Both trends increase chronic disease risk, and it means that the factors which can moderate disease risk, and diet is one of the key ones, becomes even more important than if we didn't have these trends. So I think we just need to bear that sort of background in mind while we're thinking about milk. I would want to think about other things as well, but in terms of today's talk. So the overview of what I'm going to say in the next sort of 40, 45 minutes or so is to try and look at the evidence as to whether or not consumption of milk and dairy products either increase or decrease the risk of chronic disease. That sounds a rather simple question. It's not awfully very easy to answer, actually. I want to spend a bit of time, too, just considering what type of evidence we should believe, because there's all sorts of different types of evidence out there. You'll see that we come in the end to the consideration of a balance of risk between good and evil. In a sense, we face that sort of thing every day, don't we? But this is, in the end, a balance. Actually, the balance is not as difficult to deal with as you might think. I just want to mention two things. I've already mentioned age, but I just want to mention specifically the effects of, one example of age, because the question always arises, does it matter at what age people consume milk and dairy products in terms of health risk? And also say a little bit about low-fat products, which have become more popular in recent times, particularly low-fat milk and yogurt, and some conclusions at the end. So that's the plan that we're going to go through. I thought I'd just start with a bit of light reading. This is, I think, the chairman in the introduction highlighted the fact that there has been a lot of bad press about milk and dairy products in the last few years. Certainly back with us, there has. And these are just two examples that I've picked from The Times, but it could have been other newspapers, it could have been even less reputable newspapers than The Times. Demon drink, utter confusion relates to the fact that they're saying that people don't really know whether it's good or bad. Scientists haven't really informed them properly. And there's a whole range of different similar examples to that. And only, this is this year in January, this apparently relatively eminent heart surgeon that nobody had much heard of made quite a big issue in the, but he was on the TV and in the press, in the newspapers, etc., saying that we should ban butter and it would save thousands of lives. And it says here, saturated fat is blamed for a third of the 200,000 premature deaths. And that was the basis of his argument, that because butter is rich in saturates, it should be banned. And that spawned quite a number of interesting cartoons, which I thought was quite funny. And in a sense, that cartoon embodies what we're talking about this afternoon, in the sense that we're looking at the balance between risk, the balance between good and evil in terms of risk. And these chaps obviously haven't cottoned on to the risks that they're facing. So, what is the evidence in relation to dairy products and health? I thought I would just start by really just be confirming what we're trying to do in this exercise. It's maybe obvious, but it took me a little while actually to just get to grips with it. And really all we're trying to do is to see what is the long-term effect, and we're focusing very much on vascular disease, but I'll mention other issues as well. But what is the long-term effect of consuming relatively high amounts of milk and dairy products compared with low amounts over long periods of time, years and years and years, from possibly from childhood through to old age? What is the effect of high consumption versus low consumption on particularly vascular health, but other issues as well? And that's really all we're trying to do. The approach that we've taken has been very much focused on the way in which the Cochrane collaboration dictates that both systematic reviews are carried out and also the associated meta-analyses that go with them. And Cochrane, who some of you may have heard of, quite a famous individual actually, and somebody who Peter Elwood, who I mentioned earlier, has actually worked with many years ago, he established was the inspiration behind the Cochrane collaboration, which really set the basis to evidence-based medicine and really urged that all conclusions that are used within clinical practice should use all evidence from bias-free studies. And that approach, the Cochrane collaboration still exists today, and anybody, you can go to the website and see it. And that's the kind of approach that we've taken. Interesting to note that this worker back in 1996 actually commented in a similar sort of way that public health nutrition should not be unaware of the need for evidence-based conclusions. And I think the feeling was at the time that public health nutrition was based on a rather uncertain approach to evidence, possibly still is in some cases. And that he also said that the benefits and risks associated with dairy product consumption cannot be judged simply by the effects on selected physiopathological variants. And really what he was saying, if you substitute the word selected physiopathological, he's talking about cholesterol mainly. So, based on all of that, what evidence should public health policy on milk and dairy foods be based now? We think that there are four, you could argue maybe there's more, but there are four key sources of evidence. And I've listed them here. There's evidence associated with risk factors for disease, such as cholesterol. There's the classical approach of using case control studies where you observe disease and compare that with individuals of a similar type that haven't got disease. There's prospective cohort studies which disease incidence as outcomes, and randomized control trials. And the evidence base, according to this group, for each of those increases. So number four provides the most powerful evidence. Number one provides the least powerful evidence. And I want to go through each of those in turn fairly quickly. You'll soon cotton on to the fact as we go through that all of the vast majority of our evidence comes from number three, which we believe is providing the best evidence at the minute. So starting with that one, and the chairman kind of introduced this anyway, if you look through the literature, you'll find that there are a whole range of things listed, a whole range of things raised, which suggest possible that they can possibly be used as markers of long-term health outcome. And we've just given a list of some things here. The one at the top, in terms of number of papers that we found, is, as the chairman said, it raises cholesterol. And therefore, by extension of that, it must probably be bad. But there's a whole range of other things. And I'm not going to go through them in detail, just possibly to say in passing that this whole issue of casein, or the beta-casein A1 variant, is something that's still kind of, certainly back in the UK, is still quite unclear. And there's still a lot of concern about it, not so much in relation to vascular disease, but in relation to autism or the expression of behavioural symptoms of autism, which is we won't talk about today, obviously. So, as we've seen there, the issue of cholesterol comes at that top of that list in a sense. And just a selection of papers, they're not any particular papers, just taken at random, or studies taken at random, suggests, as the chairman's doctor correctly said, that in lowest versus highest milk drinkers, there is an increase in total cholesterol in these studies of around about between sort of 7 to 10% of standard deviation. And it's on that basis, really, which many of the criticisms of milk and milk and dairy products has been based, without looking very much further. And as it says there, it's obvious in a way, but it's surprisingly how often it's forgotten. Milk is a very complex food, contains many nutrients, bioactive compounds, and other things. And in any case, it does raise the question nowadays, which cholesterol do we actually take as being the marker for disease? Many of you will be familiar, I'm sure, with the meta-analysis published by Mensink et al. A few years ago now, where they looked at the response to some of the individual saturated fatty acids that occur in milk, actually, and in other foods. And surely enough, you can see that C12, 14, 16, and C16 do certainly generally increase LDL cholesterol. But they also observed that these fatty acids also increase HDL cholesterol. And HDL cholesterol, of course, is generally regarded as being protective. And when you look at the ratio of total HDL cholesterol, which quite a bit of evidence suggests is probably a much better marker than either total cholesterol or the more commonly used, has been more commonly used, LDL cholesterol, you'll see that C12 and C14 actually give reductions in that ratio, which would tend to be beneficial. And it's really only palmitic acid which tends to increase it. And actually, that increase wasn't significant in that particular meta-analysis, but it probably does do that. And it raises the question, in passing almost, does the saturated fatty acid profile of dairy products represent as great a risk as traditionally thought, if you believe this interpretation? And the answer probably is no, probably isn't such a great a risk as was traditionally thought. I think it shouldn't be ignored. We can maybe discuss that at the end if anybody's interested, but it's certainly probably not such a big issue as it might have thought to have been a while ago. On the other hand, of course, if you look at other issues, and the other issues that we've focused very much on is the effect of milk consumption and blood pressure. And again, we've selected just a selection of papers which show that in the highest versus the lowest consumers, there is a reduction in blood pressure, often in some cases over relatively short periods of consumption, a reduction in blood pressure, again in the order of between sort of 7, 8 to 10% of standard deviation, of a similar sort of relative magnitude to the increases in total cholesterol. And of course, blood pressure too is a risk factor for vascular disease. And so that would suggest that milk is actually playing a positive role. So in terms of the overall sort of concept of using what we've called associations with risk factors for disease, the sort of scheme that we have is milk drinking is the determinant. The risk factors that we look at can be a whole range of things, but we've focused very much on cholesterol, which is increased possibly, blood pressure, which is lowered. But of course, what impact does that combination have on disease outcome? And indeed, what about other mechanisms that are almost certainly going on with such a complex food? So we have great doubts about the value of certainly the use of individual risk factors in terms of milk and dairy products. And it also raises the question as to how you combine risk factors. We're not sure anybody's really ever tried to do that. If we then move to the next level of evidence, this is the retrospective case control studies, which are inevitably based on patients. And the strategy here is that in this example, you would take patients that have had heart attack, could be a stroke, but just in this example, and you match those with control patients that have no evidence of vascular disease. And both groups are questioned about their earlier consumption of milk and dairy products. And then the literature is the way you would look at that, the overview of that would be to search literature for relevant case control studies, examine them for heterogeneity, or homogeneity if you like, and then if possible combining them with a meta-analysis to give an overall estimate of risk. And we've done that. We've selected four case control studies that we thought were worth looking at further. And you can see the strategy And it's interesting, of course, that the number of cases, the number of controls is never always, or very rarely is the same. It's actually quite difficult to do that. It's quite close here and here. And we find that from those studies overall, they suggest that the risk of myocardial infarction from high milk consumption is between sort of 10 and 22% less in the high consumers versus the low consumers. And overall, the relative risk of high consumers versus low consumers would be about, we've estimated to be about 0.83. In other words, nearly 20% reduction in relative risk. However, we do feel that case control studies have great limitations. The first limitation, which is obvious, if you're interested in milk and dairy product consumption and mortality, you cannot use case control studies because people that, after they're dead, can't tell you what they've consumed. The other problem is that, and this is a problem that can be that occur in several levels, that milk drinking may be associated positively or negatively with other health-related behaviours. I might touch on that again later. And there are also problems with recall, particularly in patients that are maybe ill, and even with controls that may be ill, because very often controls are taken from patients in the same hospital that are not suffering from vascular disease, but nevertheless may still not be well, and this can introduce bias. So case control studies are not perfect evidence by any means. They're useful, supporting evidence very often, but they do have great limitations. And the next level, which I want to spend a bit more time on, is the use of prospective cohort studies. And crucially, these are prospective cohort studies where we have disease outcome, where we have disease incidence as the outcome. And the strategy here is quite straightforward in a sense. Determinants are as before. Milk drinking is recorded for a large number of usually healthy subjects at the very beginning of these studies. And these are then followed up on long periods of time very often. And new cases of vascular disease or other things are recorded. But it's done in a controlled fashion. These are established studies set up for long periods of time with specific outcomes as objectives, if you like. So the strategy there is more or less I've said. And the overview that we've taken is that you would again do literature researching according to the structured approach for literature reviews and meta-analysis, having established whether or not studies can be combined into a meta-analysis, through a meta-analysis, to give an overall estimate of risk. And this is really where we spent most of the time in the last sort of couple of years, trying to draw together evidence from prospective cohort studies with disease incidences, outcomes. And I just want to go through some of the results of that now. The first area that we've looked at is dairy food consumption and all-cause mortality. And these are the studies that we went through the systematic review process where we used, obviously, computer-aided searching to establish all the papers that we felt were relevant according to the keywords we've fitted into it. And then we screened all of the studies for quality according to fairly specific quality standards, and only those which met those quality standards then went into the possibility of meta-analysis, and then the data from each of the studies is then checked for heterogeneity. And the decision on whether to include the data in meta-analysis is essentially based on a judgment about heterogeneity. And these are the ones that we've ended up with. Now, I won't go through them in any great detail, but you can see that they deal with relatively large numbers. And overall, we ended up with about 0.64 million person years, 5,000 deaths, no significant heterogeneity between studies, which is good, and overall a relative risk of about 0.87. In the 20% of subjects with the highest consumption, they have roughly 13%, though they had roughly 13% reduction in risk compared with those that had the lowest consumption. And these are the confidence intervals, so you can see that these, I think most of the ones I'll show you, are all significantly less than one. Of great interest has been this issue of heart disease, particularly ischemic heart disease. We found a lot more studies that were relevant to this, and this is the ones we've ended up with. There's quite a few studies that we didn't include for reasons I've mentioned. We ended up with 4.3 million person years, 16,000 events, no heterogeneity, which is good, and an overall relative risk in the highest consumers of about 0.92, so nearly 10% reduction in relative risk. Again, significantly less than one. There was one study, that just to mention it in passing, that we were concerned about, and were concerned whether we should include it or not include it. This is the Hugh study. It's actually from the nurses cohort, which you might be familiar with, a large cohort that's been used for all sorts of things. And they were split into two groups, those that consumed whole milk and those that consumed skim milk. And you can see that while skim milk fits the relative risks for more or less all of the studies in there, whole milk was stood out really like a sore thumb. And we're never really sure why that is. It's not obvious from the study design. It's not obvious from what the study reports. But it's odd. And we ended up, to cut a long story short, trying to look at the data that they had. And we've come to the conclusion that if we assume, possibly wrongly, but nevertheless we've not any other better way of doing it, that 20% of the women in the cohort were drinking whole milk, 80% of the skim milk, the overall risk from those two is about 0.91, which is roughly similar to the overall picture that we've seen. In the end, we felt that the best overall estimate was probably obtained by including the data for skim milk, which were homogeneous with the rest of the data set. The whole milk data were quite heterogeneous, and we ended up, that's how we ended up with the overall risk of 0.92. But if you included those data in that fashion, you would not get a very different answer. I'll come back later to this issue of whole and low-fat products. We spent quite a bit of time on stroke as well, because stroke is certainly with us the biggest, the second largest cause of death from vascular disease after heart disease. And this table here is again the set of data from the stroke data that we've selected. In truth, the data here are mostly ischemic stroke, and I'll say a little bit about hemorrhagic stroke in a minute. Quite a large set, 8.4 million years, person years, nearly 10,000 events. There was some heterogeneity, which was unfortunate, and that was kind of dealt with as best as possible. But overall, we ended up with a relative risk in the high group versus the low group of 0.79. Again, significant. There were fewer data relating specifically to hemorrhagic strokes, but you can see that, and there were more, there were a bit more varied actually, but overall we ended up with a similar relative risk than we found with ischemic stroke. And in fact, we also found about three or four studies which weren't really enough to draw great conclusions from studies which involved subarachnoid hemorrhage as the outcome. And again, it was rather similar, and we were slightly puzzled by that, because the etiology of subarachnoid hemorrhage is quite different to hemorrhages which occur in the brain proper, if you like. But of course, the whole issue of blood pressure might be relevant, because it would still be protective against subarachnoid bleeds as well as, if you like, the more common hemorrhages. We're also interested in diabetes. This is actually type 2 diabetes, and you might say why, since that's not strictly a vascular disease. It's not, but of course it is very often associated with vascular disease. People that develop type 2 diabetes, particularly if not properly managed, have a vastly increased risk of vascular disease. And indeed, in many cases, their eventual outcome is a vascular disease problem. And so we thought it was interesting to look at this, and particularly, of course, because the trends that we've seen in obesity are also increasing the risk of diabetes quite considerably. Quite interesting, we found no significant heterogeneity amongst the studies, not such a large set, but getting on towards 2 million person years, 7,000 cases, and a relative risk of about 0.85, again, significantly less than 1. And that was interesting, and we thought quite potentially quite important. So if we kind of summarise all of those that I've shown so far, we find that only in the case of strokes do we get significant heterogeneity, which is creates a little bit of a problem in that it's more difficult to combine the data through meta-analysis. But overall, you can see that relative risks are in the order of about 0.8 to 0.9. We just thought it was interesting to compare those outcomes with three other reviews of cohort studies that have been published in the last 2 or 3 years. And of course, in reality, some of these will include some of the same studies that we've included in ours. That's almost inevitable. Bob Gibson's study last year, he ended up with 12 cohort studies in relation to coronary heart disease specifically. And they concluded there were no consistent findings to support the concept that dairy food consumption is associated with a higher risk of coronary heart disease. The Mente study, 5 cohort studies, no significant association with coronary heart disease. And the Bonhuith study, which is just published a few months ago and actually isn't a review of cohort studies, it's actually a single cohort study, but I thought it was worth putting in because it's a new one and it's quite a long term, it's an Australian one. And they concluded there was a possible benefit between the intake of full-fat dairy products and cardiovascular mortality. That association needs further assessment. So it's a similar kind of conclusion to the other two and a similar conclusion to what we found as well. One of the topics that always comes up, this is the sort of second phase of this study, the topic that came up inevitably at the end of the first phase, most of the data that we've been able to find relates to milk. And then most of the data I've shown you so far, although the title says milk and dairy products, because some of the studies have little bits of cream in or little bits of yogurt in reality they are mostly milk. So what is the question always comes up, what about individual dairy products? Is milk and cheese the same thing? And of course there's millions of different cheeses. Is butter and milk the same thing? So we tried to look at this, not very successfully you'll see. We found only 3 cohort studies that were worthwhile for butter. There was significant heterogeneity. We found a non-significant reduction in relative risk for the high consumers, for vascular disease events in the high consumers. The low consumers, there were 2 cohorts we couldn't include. They were so heterogeneous and there were other problems with them as well. There were 3 case control studies that we looked at. And you can see the case control studies, these ORs incidentally are what are called odds ratios. They're just a slightly, they're not quite the same as relative risks, but more or less the same for the purposes of this. And you can see that these produced extremely high odds ratios. You know, increasing risk enormously by consuming butter. But bear in mind about what we said before about the value of case control evidence and the fact that these two don't agree with each other. Cheese is similar in the sense that we found only 2 cohort studies that we felt were worthwhile trying to include any sort of meta-analysis. And again, we got a very similar picture to butter. About a 0.9 relative risk, but not significantly less than 1 for vascular disease. A number of studies that we felt were not good enough to include. And 3 case control studies, which did actually give a similar picture to the cohort studies for cheese. But the picture overall for cheese and butter, we found actually really surprising how few good studies there have been which you could actually use. So summarising the cohort studies then, more or less as I did a minute ago, but adding on the fact that we've struggled really with butter and cheese in relation to vascular disease, and there was no studies at all in relation to other diseases that we could find that were relevant. So summarising those then, the whole point in a sense of doing systematic reviews is to summarise the best evidence available on a particular issue and indicate those issues on which more evidence is required. And we just wanted to highlight, I guess, that the whole issue of butter and cheese is definitely one of those issues on more evidence is required. So the heart surgeon may have been right. We don't know. I just wanted to go on and say a little bit about what are we doing for time? A little bit about dairy foods and cancer. It's not something that we've, as our group has not studied in detail, I have to say. We've been quite heavily reliant on the fact that 2 or 3 years ago, the World Cancer Research Fund and the American Institute of Cancer Research published their major report, which was, in a sense, a systematic review and meta-analysis of the data in relation to cancer. It was obviously not just dairy foods that they looked at. The literature is pretty extensive on this, actually. It's quite interesting. but a vast majority of the data are based on case control and not prospective studies. So these are just the data from the WCRF report 2 or 3 years ago. And we just wanted to highlight the fact that they concluded that in relation to colon cancer, there did seem to be some evidence of a reduction in relative risk for high consumers, possibly some evidence for bladder cancer, but they also suggested that for prostate cancer, of course, which, as we know, only affects us disadvantaged men, there did seem to be a slight increased risk in high consumers versus low consumers. And it says there, no, the cancer found to be associated. There has been quite a lot of talk back in the UK, certainly, well, in Europe in general, about the association between milk dairy products and breast cancer. And it's just worth saying that one of the large European cohort studies that's been running for a while now, the EPIC study, just published its first 10-year data on breast cancer last year and found no association between milk and dairy products and breast cancer incidence. And that was quite a large set. So these were the conclusions of the WCRF. Milk probably protects against colon cancer. Limited evidence suggesting that cheese, in contrast to milk, is a cause of... It was really very limited evidence. Limited evidence that milk protects against bladder cancer. And it suggests that diets high in calcium are a probable cause of prostate cancer. In fact, there have been 2 or 3 quite eminent reviews, sort of systematic reviews, I think, since WCRF published on the whole topic of milk and dairy products and prostate cancer. And I think I'm right in saying the general feeling is now that the relative risk is probably around 1. In other words, there's probably not that much real evidence that that is the case. But we shouldn't ignore it. We shouldn't ignore it if there's possibly something there. So finally, on this area of evidence, the randomized control trial. Now, the randomized control trial in most situations is regarded as the gold standard. It's set up in a specific way, specific treatments, and what's going to tell me here, isn't it? Specific treatments and carried out with specific protocols. I just felt it was worth saying that so far, as we can find, there has been no randomized trial. That is, no randomized control trial with death or survival relative to particular outcomes as the outcomes. To do that, the trial would have to have what it says. It would have to have adequate power. It would have to have enormous power. It would have to be very large. Some rough power calculations suggest at least 10,000 subjects. I suspect that's possibly an underestimate. Over long periods of time, half of that group would have to agree to drink milk or dairy, consume dairy foods at a relatively high level, and the other would have to agree to either abstain or be very low. It would have to be at least 5 years. That's actually Peter's estimate, not mine. I think it would have to be a lot longer than 5 years. You'd have to have very high compliance throughout, and in fact, I'm sure many of you realise, having compliance in 12-week intervention studies is really difficult, never mind 5 or 10 year intervention studies. So it's highly unlikely, we think, that it will ever be done. It's probably unacceptable. Maybe unacceptable ethically. It would be probably really difficult to get people recruited into it, and it would almost certainly be unfundable in the current economic climate anyway. So that leaves us with the sources of evidence that I've mentioned. Risk factors, probably invalid, unless you can consider all of them together, which hasn't been done. Case control studies, based on patients, limited evidence, but overall for this exercise, suggestive of some benefit. Prospective studies, highly suggestive of benefit, although but got to bear in mind that there could be confounding factors which we haven't taken care of. It's unlikely that there are any major ones, but it's just a possibility. And randomized control trials, non-conducted and non-likely to be conducted. So we've tried to summarize this in this kind of so-called forest plot, where we put the relative risks of some of these key disease outcomes on the one graph, and you can see how they go. We put in the WCRF prostate cancer figure just slightly above 1. And in fact, these are all WCRF figures. And we've tried to link those to the risk of dying from these various conditions. We accept these are UK data, but if you look all around Europe, you'll find that ischemic heart disease and stroke are still by far the largest causes of death. It's gone down, of course, over the last 20, 30 years, but it's still the largest. And in fact, there are other forms of vascular disease which aren't accounted for by those, which are almost as many as stroke, actually. So vascular disease in general is still by far the largest cause of premature death, anyway. And you can see the other ones are relatively small compared with those. And we've tried to link these risks with this evidence here, and have come to the conclusion, really, that we've tried to sort of derive this so-called survival advantage issue. In other words, high consumption of milk, whilst certainly in men, might give a slight increased risk here, but overall there seems to be evidence of a survival advantage from increased consumption. And I've specifically said milk because, as I've said earlier, the evidence for cheese and butter and so forth is not really there. Now, I just wanted to just say a little bit about, I mentioned at the very beginning, I said something about age. And I just wanted to mention this study, which I think is a really important one. It was just published last year, not included in our meta-analysis, because it's a bit of a different study. But this is the Boyd-Orr cohort, which some of you may have heard of. These were children that were recruited into this study in the 1930s. And they were then followed up over the period 48 to 2005. So a very long follow-up period. And their outcomes in terms of causes of death were then related to their diet, a range of dietary factors in that childhood period. And in terms of the data on milk and dairy products, it's quite interesting that in terms of stroke, they showed that, and they use the term hazard ratio, I just want to confuse you. It's kind of similar to relative risk. It has a time element built into it. It's not quite the same, but it is, for the purposes of today, still a sort of relative risk. In the highest calcium consumers versus the lowest calcium consumers, the hazard ratio, relative risk, if you want, was 0.41. In other words, considerably less than 1. And, of course, a high proportion of that calcium would come from milk and dairy products. And in terms of all-cause mortality, the highest versus the lowest consumption of dairy products in milk or calcium had a hazard ratio of 0.77, which is not that different to some of the relative risks that we've seen in what are essentially mostly adult studies. And this is interesting. It's only one study, but it does suggest, you probably know more than that, but it does suggest that consumption of dairy products in this childhood period, and that was really in the period in the first 10 years of life, really, has some long-term effect on health outcome. Of course, what isn't fully known in this study, and it's something we've been trying to get at, was there habitual consumption of milk and dairy products in childhood continued through adult life, or was it not? In general, apparently, it often is the case that early life sets the sort of agenda, if you like, for later on. But I thought that was an interesting one. And then, sort of finally, the issue of low-fat milk products. Well, we tried to sort this, and we asked this question. We thought was the appropriate question. Do fat-reduced milks and dairy foods provide any additional advantage? Or does the reduction in fat reduce the benefits of whole milk or whole products? We fished around in the literature, and I've deliberately not shown you them all. We found quite a lot of studies that report disease rates in subjects consume what's called natural dairy products, natural dairy foods, in other words, full fat ones, and those have consumed reduced fat products. The data are hopelessly confounded, and because they've very often been associated with health-related behaviours of the subjects on low-fat products. So they've changed lifestyle. They've increased exercise or they've done a whole range of other things, and that they're impossible to interpret in the terms that we would want to do. And therefore, we believe that at the minute, the statement which Bruce German and colleague gave a few years ago now is still appropriate, that such hypotheses, i.e. about fat-reduced milks, that specifically was, are the basis of sound scientific debate, that's for sure, but they are not the basis of sound public health policy because of the fact that the evidence isn't there. Having said that, I do happen to think there is a little bit of something in this. And I just wanted to show you one study, and there are now several like this, which have looked at the effect of full-fat versus low-fat products on effects on blood pressure. Now, I know this is contradicting to some extent what I said earlier. This is picking one risk factor in isolation, but blood pressure, I think, is probably very crucial. And this was the Rotterdam study published last year, and they showed essentially that over a two-year period. It actually lasted longer than that. This is, I think, the first 2 years. But the incidence of hypertension, these are in adults in mid to later life, who have a much greater risk of hypertension, of course. They showed that as milk consumption or product consumption increased, that it was only in milk and milk products and low-fat dairy products where there was a consistent reduction in blood pressure. A reduction in risk of hypertension. Cheese and high-fat products, it didn't occur and in fact increased in some cases. And that's very similar to the PREDIMED study, which was also published last year, which was much older subjects. These are people 60 to 80, but in fact a lot were over 70. And they were all had high risk factors for CVD. And also in those studies, it was only in the low-fat products that they showed a reduction in blood pressure over the first, I think it was the first year of the study that I can recall. I think it maybe went on a bit longer than that. So there may just be something about this low-fat thing in relation to blood pressure. But I'm not trying to put too much weight on that, but I do think we shouldn't ignore it. And it does clearly need more information. So, in conclusion, Mr. Chairman, what overall do we think is the evidence from epidemiology? We think, in a sense, that is the evidence, in the way that I've already discussed. And we believe that the prospective studies that we've looked at provide, at the minute, the best evidence that there is around and are suggestive of an overall survival advantage in high consumers of milk particularly. So, some specific conclusions. Milk, and again, advisedly using the word milk, appears to offer some vascular protection and probably provides some overall survival advantage in high consumers. Vascular benefits may be due to effects on blood pressure and possibly also on BMI control. I've not said anything about that today. I put it in because we have a project running on milk and dairy products and BMI control. There is certainly evidence that it can help in maintain or avoid increases in BMI. The advantages that we've talked about may not apply to cheese and butter, and still a question about fat-reduced products, fat-reduced milk. I think we have to be obviously a bit careful. It's quite easy to get carried away with these stuff. Epidemiology clearly does not assess cause. It doesn't assess mechanisms. It assesses associations. And there's always the risk of confounding factors that you haven't taken care of. All the studies that we've included in meta-analysis have all adjusted for a whole range of factors that typically are adjusted for, like age, smoking, race, all sorts of things, socioeconomic elements, but there's always the risk that there's something been missed. But what we would say is that it would be actually very surprising if, when you look at the whole array of data, that there was confounding factors which changed, that have been missed in all of them, which changes the picture substantially. Epidemiology should definitely direct and focus research effort. And I guess we find it perhaps a bit disappointing that it doesn't seem to have done that, at least not in our part of the world. And I think finally it should remind us that we consume foods, we don't consume molecules. There's always the risk of getting kind of tied up in individual fatty acids, for example, or even families of fatty acids. We don't consume fatty acids, we consume foods, and there may be other things in those foods which reduce the risk associated with some of the fatty acids, for example. And possibly milk, we could argue, is the most misunderstood. They're just in passing the two papers that most of the data that I've shown have come out of. The paper in lipids is not yet in sort of paper form. It's just published, I think, last month or the month before electronically, but it will be in paper form in due course, if anybody's interested. So thank you very much. No. Sorry. Yes, the question was that I didn't mention I didn't mention obesity or the metabolic syndrome as outcomes, if you like. I didn't. I did mention type 2 diabetes, and type 2 diabetes is one of the key consequences of both of those things. We have actually specifically looked at the metabolic syndrome. One of the problems with the metabolic syndrome is that it depends whose definition of the metabolic syndrome you use, because there are three or four different accepted definitions, and they all vary a bit. We have looked at the metabolic syndrome as best we could, and we get the same sort of outcome, that you get a slight reduction in risk. And that's not surprising, because it's all kind of connected to the whole issue. So I didn't mention it, but we have looked at that. Or to be more truthful, Peter Elwood has looked at that. He has actually published, I think about 3 or 4 years ago, a paper which specifically targeted the metabolic syndrome. So I could give you the reference if you're interested. with difficulty. The problem is that all of the studies tended to use slightly different. Most of these studies actually just divide consumption into quartiles or quintiles, and often actually, and really surprisingly, actually never say what the highest quintile is or what the lowest quintile is. That is a real problem. What we would say is that for most of the studies where we have got some evidence on that, high consumption would be somewhere in the order of at least 250 millilitres per day. And in some cases, it's actually 500 and more. So it's in that sort of range. Sorry, can you just repeat that? Right. Yeah, what you mean is, what would be the effect of milk and dairy products consumed along with a high-fat diet? In other words, would it reduce the risks associated with a high-fat diet? No, we haven't specifically looked at that, is the short answer. Adam? Well, I think there's two things, really. I think the first is a policy issue. And I think, at least our view is, that we have to engage with the organisations that are responsible for food policy or for nutrition policy. And one of the problems that we've faced, actually, is that we don't find them terribly receptive. And I'm not entirely sure why that is. But I think that is the first step. I think the second step is that we have to be very honest, and, as I said a minute ago, accept that this sort of approach isn't giving us all the answers. It's pointing us in the areas in which we should be actually looking for more mechanistic evidence, if you like. And one of the areas that we certainly want to develop is a more holistic approach to assessment of vascular disease risk. And there's now one or two, there's a few now probably good ways at looking at vascular disease risk in terms of vascular reactivity, for example, endothelial function, which we want to introduce into the milk scenario to see whether, in fact, it is giving us the sort of outcomes in the relatively short-term studies that the long-term studies are suggestive of. Well, there's probably lots. We think that one of the key positive things is the effect on blood pressure. And there are at least, there are more certainly, but there are at least two elements there that probably, two things in milk which are probably responsible for that. I mean, everybody says that milk's a great source of calcium, and it certainly is, and that's obviously important for all sorts of things. But calcium has very subtle roles, and calcium is involved in the modulation of vascular reactivity, and almost certainly plays a role in this blood pressure reduction effect. Milk proteins also probably give rise to, during digestion, give rise to peptides, which have blood pressure reducing effects. There's a lot of evidence that these peptides exist. I'm less convinced, unless Adam says different, that there's actually mechanistic evidence that these peptides are actually absorbed and work post-absorptly. But nevertheless, they do have quite powerful, some of them do have quite powerful blood pressure reducing effects. So there's a range of things, but I think the effects of things on blood pressure are probably some of the key ones. Sorry, what data? Yeah. No, we haven't. But to be fair, we haven't looked. But I suspect, on the basis of what we found for cow milk, I would suspect that there's not much. But we haven't looked. But it's a good question, because there is quite an interest in alternative milks. Well, yes, it's true. It's not something we've tried to do, actually, but this whole issue of food replacement is an important one, and the fact that people, as you say, drink less milk, they will be doing something else. They will probably be replacing it, but it's not something we've looked at. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and that's right, that's important. No, there isn't really. I mean, there's been a whole range of things suggested as being possible contributors to the risk. The two that stick in my mind, because they're the two that have been pestering us, if you like, is this issue of IGF-1 and the fact that you do see an IGF-1 spike after consumption of milk, and there's been a concern that this is a contributor. Also, the fact that milk does contribute questionable amounts of estrogens, and that has been a bit of a concern. But there's a whole range of things. But and the calcium issue too. There's been suggestions that the calcium does play a part in the story. So there's the two or three things. There's been more than that suggested, but the evidence for all of them is not strong. No, I didn't. But you're right, it's important. Well, I mean, there have been a number of animal models used, particularly in relation to vascular disease, particularly in relation to atherosclerosis. There's a group at the University of Nottingham, for example, where Adam has spent some happy years, that I think have developed, is it a hamster model or a guinea pig model? A transgenic mouse model, which seems to be quite good specifically for the development of atherosclerosis, but we are, I guess, not terribly convinced about animal models in the more holistic sense. We would much rather try and use real animals ourselves.
Well, is there any final questions?
No, I didn't. I didn't. I did actually originally have some slides in on this issue, but I thought I better not show them because of the lack of time. But the question really is, given the evidence that we've seen there, the apparently somewhat beneficial effect in relation to vascular disease, is there then any benefit in trying to develop milk products which have some of the saturated fat replaced with something else? Either with monounsaturates, probably with monounsaturates, possibly with some polyunsaturates. That's an important question because there's a lot of people trying to do that, including us. The evidence so far is slim. We have found only about 6 intervention studies which have looked at the effect of replacing saturates with either monounsaturates or polyunsaturates on markers of health outcome. And those markers have tended to be cholesterol, in some cases nothing but cholesterol, in some cases with a few other things such as some of the inflammatory markers, CRP and other things. Overall, based on that limited evidence, there is an indication that there may still be some additional benefit. But it's not very strong evidence.
Okay, let's thank Professor Ian Gibbons for the talk.